morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. A Bible theme park has been proposed for Rutherford County. It has generated a great deal of discussion. Recently, Dr. Bill Levine, a professor in our English department, delivered a lecture on campus based on his scholarly analysis of what he witnessed at a Bible theme park already in operation and open for business in Orlando, Florida, taking an historical overview of religious iconography and putting it into context. And Bill is here to talk with us about that right now. UWMOT listeners are already familiar with Bill Levine and his interviews with the jazz greats and near greats that you listen to on this station. So he is no stranger to the WMOT audience, but it's nice to have him on the record. Thanks for being here, Bill.
Sure. Thanks, Jenna. Happy that I can follow up on some of the talks I've been giving recently here and in Portland in my American Society for 18th Century Studies National Convention. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Tell us, first of all, what you observed when you went to the Orlando Bible theme park.
Well, we have a place that's in transition. This was founded from one man's ministry, basically a man named Marvin Rosenthal, dedicated to the conversion of Jewish people in a way of preparing for the final judgment. But in 2001, he had the backing to build this park called the Holy Land Experience in Orlando, kind of occupying a little bit of higher ground among SeaWorld, Disney World, and Paramount Studios. So what I saw there, I'd say it essentially revolved around four or five major exhibits that were simulating in the somewhat, what I would say, distorted view of the beliefs of the founder, simulating sites in first century Jerusalem and to some extent what we would now say is the state of Israel, too. So models of the Dead Sea Scroll caves and a half-scale model of Herod's Temple, which served as the site of theatrical entertainments, a simulation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, which used lots of lasers and smoke to simulate the divine aura. And, you know, I'd say the most effective, in some ways most disturbing of all those pavilions in the park was a building shaped like a Byzantine basilica that was completely automated and self-guided for various moments in the history of the Bible, the history of the Word, as it survived various challenges, temporal power. So we have a series of martyrs essentially going back from ancient times, the scriptural world, the founding of the two major churches, and into English and American culture, you know, into our Puritans and our own prairie and modern American life.
Yeah. Is there any reason to believe that the people behind the Murfreesboro theme park were in any way inspired by what the Orlando park has done?
Well, I've only briefly looked at their publicity materials, Jenna, and they are trying to give themselves a somewhat different focus and sector to try to empty out any claims of sectarian influence, as you know, Mr. Rosenthal's vision obviously adhered to. And, of course, that park last summer taken over by Trinity Broadcasting, major Christian broadcasting network, media empire, and they're not addressing that issue at all. But, yeah, definitely. I think whether they want to admit or not, they're influenced by the use of mass technology and media culture, theme park culture, just as Rosenthal was to design their park. They want to make it bigger and better, and of course they're doing it openly for profit rather than as some kind of extension of a ministry or, you know, of what the Christian Broadcasting Network's media empire. This is in business for itself, I would generally think.
You referred to in your lecture to an artist, a French artist of the 18th century, I believe. Or 19th century.
Well, he kind of on the border of both, and actually a very strange, eccentric life, even for some of the stories we've heard of 18th century and early 19th century artists. But his name was Philippe Jacques de Loutherbourg, and even that name was the product of a certain amount of self-invention. The D before de Loutherbourg was his own, giving himself a title. So he was born in Strasbourg, actually, in the mid-18th century. So that's the border of Germany and France, and after a brief flashy early career as a French artist embraced by the Academy, by Diderot, one of the major art critics of the time, the philosophe, he migrated to England, emigrated, and worked for the major theatrical company in Drury Lane, David Garrick, the theater entrepreneur, and you know, in England too, he became very much a legitimate artist embraced by the Royal Academy, the academic institution. So his remaining years, like the last, I don't know, 40 to 50 years of his life were spent in England, with very few exceptions. So.
De Loutherbourg, as I believe I mentioned before when I spoke to you, what few paintings of his I could find depicted online were mostly of nature scenes and ships in storm-tossed seas. We're not depicting of any religious iconography, but there was an extraordinary passion and flash about his work that just jumped out at you, even from a computer screen. Is this applicable to his religious sensibilities as well?
Well, you know, again, in some ways, I think he used religion and occult, hermetic knowledge in a way that gave a certain aura to his art, you know, regardless of whether he was making a certain profit during his brief retirement from painting as a faith healer, you know, using the whatever mesmerism, laying on of hands, or whether he, you know, truly was a serious scholar of matters like Kabbalistic lore. There's very, I'd say, oblique, indirect ways this got into his paintings. Of course, as you mentioned, he was very much an expert in scenes of the natural sublime, of matters like shipwreck, apocalyptic types of scenes. But I think even he knew that in the climate of his world of art, he had to keep openly religious statements separate from the representation of, you know, biblical scenes, for example. And my entrance pointed to him, in fact, was because he was the major illustrator, 22 out of 71 plates for a very ambitious Bible illustration project that took off in 1790, lasted until about 1816, had some problems getting, capital exports during the Napoleonic blockades. But Loutherbourg did 22 of 71 illustrations, and, you know, many of them do cover the prophetic books, the Book of Revelations, the Apocrypha, where he actually did front pieces and various vignettes, engravings that used Kabbalistic symbols. But certainly his scenes of the biblical world rose head and shoulders above conventional British academic painting of the time, because they do suggest this motion and supernal kind of quality, supernatural aura in them. And, you know, the other point of entrance into this comparison between his tactics and Bible Park tactics of today, is as far fetched as it might seem, was his foray into what we could almost say is the London popular entertainment world, an invention called an eidophysikon, which basically translates into representation of images of nature, using some of the theatrical techniques he learned working for Garrick. So various kinds of cutouts and mechanical soldiers, things like that, lighting and filtering, music. So the first multimedia entertainment, even though it was in basically a gallery room in only a 3-foot by 6-foot diorama, perhaps 9 foot deep, and the most religious quote-unquote scene would have been from John Milton's great epic poem Paradise Lost, the scene of the fallen Satan rousing up his troops and building the temple pandemonium in hell. But, you know, even that was accepted within secularized literary conventions. And, you know, the other scenes were, of course, about the force, the might of nature, or of things like battle scenes or Niagara Falls Falls even was a popular scene at that time. So, of course, a transcendental or immanent sense of divinity in nature, but not, you know, openly religious in the sense that, you know, trying to recreate every major episode in, you know, biblical course of history as a theme park might be doing today.
When you look at religious iconography down through the ages, based on what you've seen at the Orlando Park, how does 21st century digital technology and the use of man-made materials such as plastic that were synthesized as a result of the space age fit into and compare with the historic overview of religious iconography of prior centuries when they were using God-made materials like wood and earth and clay?
Sure. One frame for my talks and analysis is a very well-regarded essay, even if it sometimes is rather speculative and idealistic, but a German critic who actually didn't survive World War II, Walter Benjamin. It's called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, and he was very enthusiastic about the invention of cinema in, say, the 1910s, 1920s, because he felt that this could be liberating. It could engage the masses so as to rise to a more, what can we say, socially conscious, alert position of their potential power and, you know, ultimately some sort of higher position of control in society. But, of course, he realized, you know, Hollywood had commodified much of the early film industry and it was still essentially a, you know, profit-making device. But he said that film had this ethic of, or aesthetics of, motion, distraction, you know, deliberately artificial, almost like a form of surgery to create a new reality. And he saw the aura of traditional religious art, of course, fading. There's, you know, certain nostalgic qualities when he talks about it, but that element of closeness and contact and maybe, like what you said, some sense of an organic connection between the aura, the spirit of whether it's theatrical art, painting, you know, traditional church art, that is smashed in a way like the iconoclast tried to do in the Puritan era of the Reformation. So, I think that when I go to a theme park, I'm always very ironic about the use of heavy equipment from tactics that have already been tried out and put into effect in Disneyland, say, to make us imagine a perfect city of the future or to make us talk to animatronic versions of the presidents, for example. I mean, I see that there's almost no holds barred in what artificial devices can create illusions, can create this kind of buzz and, you know, maybe always some challenge to go beyond earlier levels of stimulation or supposedly realistic effects. So I think when you take that out of maybe the earlier forms of art that were based in more solemnity, more of a community kind of connection between the, let's say, the drama of religion and the parishioners, more of a level playing field, so to speak, obviously not just something that's manufactured for the sake of promotion and gaining a market share. You know, I really think the artificial materials of today's versions of Bible-themed culture are just the tip of the iceberg in a sense of, you know, this loss of some anchoring or stability in religion is essentially, I would almost have to say, a private matter rather than something subject to this extreme form of publicization and, you know, kind of in-your-face explosion of media tactics and devices.
The types of materials used in constructing the icons might seem a rather nuanced way of looking at it, almost having a subconscious effect. It's not the thing sort of one might necessarily discuss. But I think, for example, of the Mennonite gentlemen who have come to my mother's home on occasion and whom we have paid to do repair work and such, and who would request respectfully that we turn off the television and the radio when we were doing so, because to have those electronic devices on in their presence would offend their sensibilities. So it can Would a Bible theme park be something necessarily that people of all faiths could even necessarily embrace depending upon their particular beliefs?
Mm-hmm. Yes, this is a very worthy question of historical study, because I clearly saw an ancestry genealogy of the theme park in Florida with efforts to convert Jews back in Victorian England, you know, evangelical-led efforts that were constructed around dioramas of Jerusalem, you know, partly for people who couldn't get there themselves, this kind of vast, you know, technology of Victorian mass culture and entertainment, and, you know, bazaars, exhibits of Palestine, the Holy Land, which, of course, Britain had a political interest in as well, you know, basically their colony, their territory. So I would say that any successful commercial venture in religious mass culture like this couldn't limit itself just to one main group of believers. It has to be ecumenical to some degree. It has to cater to just even those who like the sensationalism of forms of secular entertainment. I mean, going back to why a film like The Ten Commandments was popular, as much as its base, its true core might be in a certain segment of our American, you know, religious culture that does have literalist beliefs in the Bible, that does obviously see, like the Reverend Rosenthal, this version of a final judgment where, you know, the embrace of Hebrew Bible and culture would be a stepping stone towards some sort of final vision of tribulation and, you know, Armageddon and the millennium. One element of my research, of course, is just about the almost absurd degree of eclecticism in modern Bible theme parks, where I do see elements of Cecil B. DeMille. Herod's Temple, of course, is used for Broadway-style, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, Godspell-type entertainments, and even if the vision of Judaism comes from Fiddler on the Roof, you know, Eastern European, to transport that into the Bible. I, you know, I'm not just troubled by the historical anachronisms, but I think by the almost, oversaturation of images to perhaps cover up certain insecurities that are inherent in this element of faith that always believes it's, in a sort of minority in a modern secular world. You know, it's the true believer against the materialistic culture, but yet it's using these tactics and devices to generate that kind of sublime you know, buzz effect of having something that sticks, that lasts, that's, you know, memorable, that creates these agitated neurological impressions, among other things, that leaves some sort of equivalent of religious experience on the visitors. As I mentioned to you in our private talk a couple of weeks ago, those people who even go down to Florida as if it is a site of pilgrimage, as if they can be healed by the theatrical workers who are dressed up as, you know, Jesus and Mary, and, you know, have little prayer intervention groups, you know, to cure their lameness, illnesses. This is beyond, I think, just going to a form of entertainment and enjoying the element of illusion. This is really jumping ahead to an element of literal belief in a place that I just see as plastic, concrete, and whatever, you know, photo devices. I'm getting the wrong word, you know, use of film, digital technology to create visual illusions as well.
It fits in, does it not, especially since it is a money-making endeavor, mm-hmm. with the entire American capitalist motif. The use of spectacle, a DeMille-like spectacle, fits the whole bigger is better mantra, does it not?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think with the park that's planned in Murfreesboro, of course, they want to say that their private enterprise can allow them to leverage capital that will go beyond any of these sectarian theme parks that simply can't create the same level of excitement. That's what I'm reading in their publicity materials. And, you know, of course, we might appreciate in America figures like P.T. Barnum, who can create these spectacles and draw people in and get them engaged in pretty much, you know, insubstantial or openly false representations. And as long as we're not victimized, I suppose we appreciate that hucksterism, that good old American ability for reinvention of the self. And taking the traveling roadshow as far as it can go. So certainly a peculiar position, you know, when I look into something like Trinity Broadcasting, where they clearly are using, you know, actors who haven't been at the peak of their career for several years and casting them in say, their traditional television typecast roles. I saw a film of theirs once late at night, you know, and I wouldn't let anyone who doesn't want to watch these suffer through them. But, you know, it was Corbin Burnson from L.A. Law and Mr. T, of course, from the A-Team, basically in an apocalyptic caper with a legal plot where, you know, of course, the lawyer who's working for the current Antichrist ends up converting and, you know, serving the martyr figure who's on trial. And, you know, of course, Mr. T tries to do some kind of explosion of the Antichrist headquarters, but, you know, falls down the process. So, you know, again, using very, I would almost say, worse written plots than what you would have seen on 80s television, but obviously using these cultural reference, you know, to show some, let's say, minority segment of popular culture that's reached higher ground, that's serving a cause and, you know, an aura of a certain celebrity in their various kinds of ventures. You know, I know they're going to make their TV studio in Orlando spectacular, you know, diamond-studded floors and gold curtains, and it'll, you know, be transported by a bridge, or people can be transported from the old Jerusalem to this kind of new Jerusalem of their TV studio. So, you know, that certainly is showing capitalistic ingenuity, but yet within a very well-defined, you know, sort of minority segment of a more purified form of popular culture. That's pretty much how I would think of it. I know they raise a lot of their funding through telethons. I'm almost thinking how much of Jerry Lewis's techniques would they use to create that kind of, you know, empathy, passion for their particular sacrificial causes, I would think, even though the founders, you know, are like, what, go back to ministries with Jim and Tammy Faye Baker in the, you know, 80s, and clearly a kind of gospel of wealth and prosperity that only a matter of faith, I guess, would say they're trickling it down to, you know, the people on some level.
The God wants you to be rich mentality of some of the people around the proselytizers around the Gilded Age, I mm-hmm. guess, of the American history. Right. I suppose Mr. T didn't just pity the fool, he obliterated the fool, huh?
Well, he tried to anyway, but I guess the you know, fool had all his you know, mechanical technological nuances planting. So, I mean, the plot seemed rather implausible anyway, that they wouldn't have stopped him in his van that had all the explosives in it. You know, nobody at the checkpoint, just happens when he gets in the gate. So, you know, certain elements of continuity that maybe a better funded Hollywood plot would have. But I know they're going to use the Holy Land experience as a backlot eventually for biblical themed films. So, you have corporate synergy pretty much enabling that kind of purchase acquisition.
Yeah. One wonders, and I don't, the technology is so new, I don't know that any scholarly research has necessarily been done on this, but in religious iconography of old, you look at the church architecture, you see the stained glass windows, you look at the paintings, you hear the music, and one can become inspired or experience that sublime neurological experience that most of us call a religious experience. Mm-hmm. But it is still mostly as an observer until you get to the interactive era in which we now live in the media, in which the human body and the human psyche become actors in the experience instead of just mere observers. One wonders if being an interactive participant, as one does active things at a theme park as opposed to just listening and watching, one wonders if that causes the iconography to have a deeper impression on the psyche, for good or for ill, because the person is actually doing something at the time they are experiencing this endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you brought up several good points. I mean, just off to the side a little bit, I think this difference between a mass culturally produced form of entertainment versus traditional, you know, folk-based arts, it's not just in the old times, you know, going back to medieval cathedrals, but I think even up here we could visit, you know, Cheekwood, the Botanical Gardens, the museum, and see sculptures from basically residual leftover cemetery stones by a cemetery worker worker for many years, I believe, up there from the African American community in North Nashville, who did carvings of angels, almost like a William Blake type of visionary experience. And whatever your beliefs are, whether you agree with this man or not, I mean, we can appreciate the devotion and the continual attempt to carve his vision out literally through whatever materials were available for him. And, again, giving testimony to his private faith, but in some way creating a work of art that has to be judged, you know, contemplated from a distance, that takes a long time to really appreciate the untrained in a sense, but very beautiful in some other senses, immersion of his life into these forms and shapes. So as we go into the more technologically enhanced forms, I think, you know, clearly some understanding of the way film media leaves more vivid impressions on the retina. One point of comparison with de Lutherborg, of course, is when a group of spectators, say 100 or in a gallery room watching these dioramas, you know, they really are impressed by what I would say is almost a miniaturized, intensified version of the sublime, but they're immersing themselves into it. It does require a certain, following of a plot, of motion, and, they're being drawn into that kind of world. So maybe going back to your division between passive and active, you know, which again in that Benjamin essay I refer to, it's a question of whether modern art is more of an element of continual distraction and motion, or modern mass entertainment anyway, versus traditional art and its element of contemplation and immersion. I think it sort of breaks down because maybe mass entertainment is about bombardment and creating a kind of passivity even as the viewer is surrounded, you know, going back to whatever sense around IMAX film techniques, they're being kind of guided by very fine-tuned stimuli. Again, you probably can go back to the days of the old church ceremonies and say, well, wasn't it still multimedia on some level, because we had passion plays, we had drama, we had very fine music, we had wonderful art. But, again, I think people, maybe it was a slower pace of life, or this was more something they almost could, feel as part of the center of their town, their community, and, you know, gradually they would appreciate more of it or be part of the congregation. You know, they would be born and raised and buried there in a sense. So to just try to compress that, as we do in modern mass culture, into, say, a day-long trip to one of these theme parks, we almost are taking, like, all of our medicine in one little capsule, and, you know, it no longer becomes medicine. It's like the antibiotic that blows out all of the unholy elements of the body, presumably through some sort of, you know, heavy explosive device of the religious sublime. So, I guess I'm trying to historicize a bit your answer. You know, when did this become more passive than active, or when did modern technology, by like the new theme park here in Murfreesboro, trying to make us do a fly through Jerusalem, is still essentially creating, you know, a virtual reality where we're being catered to rather than really asked to think. I think it's planting certain images. I mean, we hear that in teaching these days all the time. It's sort of a scary thought, you know, how visually literate our students are, even if they're losing a certain quality of critical thinking and ability to write linear essays. You know, can the visual images be used in ways that are provocative and more active and, you know, critically intervening in problems in society, as opposed to just manufacturing more of the same kind of what I would say are ultimately passive indulgences, no matter how strong the neurological stimuli are.
This is all wonderful food for thought, but with time escaping and before you get away, I must ask you, when you were at the Orlando Park, did you see any ethnic and cultural diversity among the people who patronized the park? Did you see African Americans, Asians, Arabs, people from India, Pakistan? Did you see any international and intercultural diversity?
Yeah, well, it's a little hard to tell in Florida. I mean, of course, I'd already visited parts of South Florida in my distant past, and you know, I knew about the communities of, say, Cuban emigres down there in Miami. But you know, Orlando too. Whether this is Hispanic American, whether this is you know, visitors from other, you know, countries in the Caribbean or South America, that was the strongest presence I noticed. Not a lot of African American, not a lot of other international tendencies. When I've you know, Google occasionally Holy Land experience, I see that it's the neighboring states like Georgia. Various church groups are taking, you know, busloads sometimes of retirees down there for their particular, you know, treat to see the vivid biblical tableaus come to life on that day. So without really talking to many of the patrons, you know, I understand again that this new family taking over the theme park down there, Trinity, you know, the Crouches, they have a Pentecostal basis, and I know that's made inroads in, you know, the Mexican-American population. When I lived out in Texas, I saw that firsthand, and, you know, one of the photos I took, which I felt a little self-conscious about taking, was actually a Hispanic family looking for this prayer intervention from the actor playing Jesus. You know, their child was a bit ill, but, you know, very closely huddled together, very solemn, even in the midst of this vast public carnival-like space. So, yeah, you know, I would have no doubt saying that what Trinity is trying to do, getting its demographic, its television viewers to visit this park for whatever, you know, or it will provide. You know, we're talking, I guess, about the largest growing base in American, at least with internal kind of American religions, in that this started, you know, evangelicalism with a real class distinction. I think it was kind of in response to the higher criticism or the, you know, Anglican Episcopal kind of elites, and it was really preaching in terms of, you know, enthusiasm, in terms of almost like direct revelation rather than the kind of elaborate liturgies that we see in the official, you know, churches, say, of England or the higher social class churches in America. So now I think, you know, at least in the last 20 years, it's maybe made inroads into more suburban cultures. I mean, we don't have to go far to see what's happening around, you know, Franklin or Brentwood even. You know, if we say there's soccer moms who are even embracing this as kind of a moral guide against the dangers of secular culture, you know, I think that's what might be the growing amount of contribution to the what telethons that Trinity could hold, but also, you know, people visiting parks like this. I mean, one question I have that I'd like to follow up on is whether the technologies in this theme park are really superior or somehow more concentrated than what we might see in what I would call a big box type of church, you know, the ones that have what, television studios on premises or bowling alleys, whatever. When I lived in Houston, I saw, you know, the first fruits of those churches where we had, you know, oil industry executives who made a point of making missions to the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, when it broke up, you know, both for conversion, but I think also obviously some, you know, financial interest in there too.
Networking, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, that kind of center of power is obviously coming from a certain affluence that probably couldn't have seen in evangelical movements, you know, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, I still think Billy Graham comes from a much more innocent time, though I notice they've got his son Franklin as an occasional TBN celebrity, Trinity Broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This has been a fascinating look at the possibility of a Bible theme park in Murfreesboro from an intellectual and historical perspective. And I hope that we have given you more light than heat and more information that you can digest and take in as this issue continues. It's a developing story and one that people will stay on top of, as an informed citizenry should. Dr. Bill Levine, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Jen. I enjoy talking with you.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at this same time next Sunday. And also, you can catch us at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.